Hello and welcome to another episode of the CG Garage. This is episode number 471, featuring Chris McLean, who is the overall VFX supervisor on Foundation, the series that is currently airing on Apple TV Plus. Super excited to have him on. Very, very ambitious show, as you know, by Apple TV, and having him be part of it is really, really cool. It's interesting. Chris and I probably have crossed paths many times. We've never actually met, but he was doing a lot of similar things that we were doing around the same time, which you will hear during the podcast, and we know a lot of the same people, which is kind of cool. He worked over at Mr. X for a number of years. And he did some really great stuff there, including Crimson Peak and Godless, American Gods, Resident Evil. And now, of course, he's the overall studio supervisor on Foundation. Very smart guy, very down to earth, which I really, really appreciate his candor on a lot of these great subjects. He's super busy these days, which is also good because he's also very, obviously very, very talented. We talk about a lot of things. We talk about the state of the visual effects industry. Obviously, there's been a lot of turmoil that's happened in this area, and he's sort of a really great person that made some great sense as to how things are going to change, especially in the things like AI tools, what that's going to do. We talk a lot about Gouache and Splats. And how we think that that's going to change things. Chris seems to think that we may not have polygons in the future, and he may have some good reason to think that as well. So it's really interesting to talk to him. So super glad we could get Chris on to the podcast and to talk about all these amazing things. Really, really great guy. Okay, in terms of announcements, I think product announcements, the only thing I really want to talk about is actually Project Arena, something that you guys know I have been very deeply involved with and I am very excited about. If you want to know more about Project Arena, just go to chaos.com/virtual-production, chaos.com/virtual-production, and you'll learn more about it there. A lot of people have asked, oh, can I try Project Arena? Well, it doesn't really make any sense for people to try Project Arena unless you actually have an LED stage for it to try on, because essentially what it is just Vantage that has been created and optimized to work on an LED stage. So without an LED stage, you can't really do Project Arena, but you can do Vantage, and Vantage is essentially what Project Arena is. So if you want to know more about Project Arena, all you got to do is just try Vantage, and it's a great tool, and I highly, highly recommend it. I love it. I think it's really, really interesting to see full real-time ray tracing, especially with, you know, the right hardware. It is incredibly, incredibly fast. And speaking of Vantage, there has been a new update recently, and I want to make sure you guys are aware of that. So Vantage 2 Update 3 is out. It includes several updates. One of the biggest ones is the new support for layered materials, which has been added recently, and that is a big deal. A lot of people have been asking about that, and we now have it working in Vantage. So now you have layered materials working in real-time ray tracing. Super exciting. We've also added a new multi-mat render element to Vantage. So if you need a multi-mat set of your render elements and in a Vantage render, you can get that. And we've done several other UX changes that I think will feel very beneficial. So again, just go to chaos.com to see all of that information about Vantage. In terms of events, just go to chaos.com/events for all news on our events. We do have another Chaos Unboxed event that is happening May 9th, and it's happening simultaneously in London and Madrid. So, in our London event, actually, Nikos will be teaching another class on creative lighting. So that is really exciting. I highly recommend you guys check that out. If you'd like to take his class, it is really worth it. And all of this can be found again at chaos.com/events, where you can register for all of this. Now, if you want to know more about the podcast, you guys know the deal. Our podcast page is chaos.com/CG Garage. Our Facebook page is facebook.com/CG Garage Podcast. And of course, we'd love recommendations on anyone who you'd like to have on the podcast, including this one, which was a recommendation. Just go to chaos, just email us, which is labs@chaos.com. Again, that is labs@chaos.com. But for now, please enjoy Chris McLean.
Welcome to another CG Garage, where the chaos group talks. You'll know it's over when the last bucket drops. We're gonna fire off rays in high dynamic range. We know that ambient occlusion is passe. Global illumination won't lead you astray. And while image-based lighting is really swell, you need to make sure everything has Fresnel.
But Chris, I do want to know a little bit about your history. I know I was reading a little bit about your history, and I think it's pretty interesting, okay. And your background and how you got into doing the things that you do. So I'd love to know a little bit from your side of things, like what got you into doing the things that you do now? Like how is it started? You started in Canada, is that correct?
Yeah, I started in Canada doing documentaries. Doing CG effects for like National Geographic and Discovery Channel documentaries, and then that dried up very quickly, and then ended up moving out to Toronto, got hired by Mr. X, was there for I think 12 years. I started as a junior modeler, very quickly became an asset supervisor, and you know, kind of worked my way up, CG supervisor, digital effects supervisor. I was there when we were doing Tron, I think. You may have swung by the office when it was at 35 McCall.
Yep.
I was on a different show at the time. Everybody else was working on Tron, but I can't remember. I think it was on Resident Evil. Mm-hmm. And then, we did all of the Mr. X stuff, and I hooked up with John Swallow on Godless. Did a couple shows with him before he passed, and then got the call from Michael Malone, who was my producer on The Highwaymen and Godless. Our line producer, and he had just been hired to do Foundation, and he said, I need a no BS VFX supervisor to come help me do the show. And it's actually the last conversation I had with John, because I was either going to work on Queen's Gambit, American Gods season 3, or Foundation. And you know, John was already in his his kind of hospice bed, and he said, I think his wife Lori was upstairs, and he had said, do whichever one scares you the most. And from upstairs, I heard Lori say, "It doesn't always have to be hard, John." And that was the last conversation I had with John. But I took the hard one, and I've been on the show for 5 years. So
that's amazing. Yeah. I definitely want to get into Foundation for obvious reasons, but I do want to know a little bit about what got you interested in visual effects. Like, what was it about that process? I mean, did you like filmmaking? Was it the tinkering, the creating, the problem solving?
Well, I mean, I'd always been a kind of a traditional artist, and I had gotten into graphic design out of high school. Mm. And then my now wife and I took a holiday to Sicamous, Merrill Lake, and it rained the whole time. But I had brought a PlayStation with me, and I think we were playing Metal Gear Solid, and I was like, maybe I could, take my skill set and figure out how to get into this kind of storytelling. And so I started exploring schools for game design and, 3D animation and all of that. And then my wife was like, "Movies are cooler. You should do movies." And then I'm like, all right, whatever. I went to school in Edmonton, and that's where I actually picked up the gig for the Discovery Channel stuff,
right,
from a fellow named Michael Jorgensen. But a love of storytelling and a love of digital art, I guess, which is a strange thing to say, but that's kind of how I got started was by, playing Metal Gear Solid for hours on end in a rainy condo.
Right. So, what part of it was the most interesting thing when you went to school? Obviously, there's so many different ways that people get exposed to visual effects or CG in general. Is it the modeling, the creation, the lighting, the storytelling, the animation? Like, what was the thing that really sort of got you all into it?
It was the sculpting, it was the modeling, it was the problem solving. When I eventually got into it and started actually doing it for real, working, it was, you know, it seemed insurmountable a lot of the times. It seemed impossible. But, you know, once you figured out the, you know, best practices, best way to, you know, whether it was topology or the best way to sculpt. I mean, when I started, you know, I actually took in high school, we were the one of the first high schools to get 3D Studio Max in like 1999 or something like that. But then I had kind of shelved it and came back right around the time that ZBrush, I think 2.5 had come out, and started learning how to sculpt and do all that sort of stuff. But then also just really, cause there was only two websites at the time. It was like Naaman and CG Talk, which is CG Society, which is debunked now, but those were the only places you could really go to find out how to do stuff. And, right. And so when I was in school for it, I was supplementing my education with Naaman and that CG Talk, and just kind of figuring out the best way to do things from all that. And then eventually, you know, when I landed at Mr. X, that paid off because nobody knew what non-manifold geometry was, or or knew that, you know, that could throw the renderer into a death spiral and things like that. So. You know, valances are bad, you know, that sort of stuff. Not as important anymore, but, you know.
Were you doing it with the Naaman Workshop stuff that were the supplemental videos?
I still have a lot of DVDs.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I've got a library of DVDs. And I think the Art of Rigging books were very important as well, because it kind of opened up that side of it for me. Because I tinkered in every aspect of what we do, and it eventually led me to, you know, compositing and color and, you know, rendering and lighting and all of that stuff that a CG generalist kind of has to know. So,
It was interesting because, I mean, I actually had authored a couple of DVDs for Naaman at the time. I'd done some stuff on V-Ray, which was kind of a bit of a paradigm shift, because back then it was a lot of people had a certain way of thinking about how to do things, right? And so ray tracing or complete ray tracing was sort of a new concept of a thought process there. But the same thing was true for modeling, right? When you start thinking about ZBrush, it's a completely different way of thinking about modeling. Most of the education was like NURBS patches and weird things like that. It was just impossible to use. Like, so you were right there at that shift, right? As you were thinking about,
I was right on the cusp. Like we were, using RenderMan when Tron showed up at the studio and DD had actually told us to, you know, okay, you got to use V-Ray now.
Right.
And I remember, you know, doing that shift, and it was also because, you know, when I was doing a lot of my asset development, I was doing it, you know, in Maya, in mental ray rendering with ray tracing and, you know, getting a photorealistic render. Then we would pipe that over to Houdini and RenderMan. And because of the infrastructure of RenderMan, you know, brick maps and occlusion maps, and it's all built for compositing, and you don't actually know what you're going to get until you get to compositing. And then they beat the crap out of the render passes in the comp, and they're like, ah, can you render a few more lighting passes for us? And then it just, you know, I think V-Ray, Arnold, you know, RenderMan, RIS, all that. All of that kind of changed the way that, you know, we can approach it like we do on set now.
Yes.
So, which is very nice. It's still difficult, you know, there's still a little bit of the aesthetic that we lose from, you know, it's like, you know, we're very good at imitating the sensor and what's between, the sensor and the CG, but the lens, we're still, you know, that's where I spend most of my time kind of, you know, massaging things, especially with people that, you know, cause we use a lot of anamorphic lenses and things like that. So, but we, you know, it's great. Motion blur is another big one. It's still something that you have to kind of really pay attention to. I think, you know, that's kind of like where ILM started. Right. Was you know, painting in motion blur and dealing with that sort of stuff. So they're kind of the best at it. Everybody else is kind of, you know, still have trouble with it. But
I'm curious about that, because I'm going to go a little technical sidetrack here, because that concept of the lensing, right? Because it is actually technically possible to imitate lensing as a ray tracing very accurately. That's the nature of what a ray tracer does. But it's often asked not to do it because they want the flexibility of manipulating it in comp, which makes it, like, you know, so it's not quite look right, because you have to do it in comp, right?
If we do it in comp, I mean, obviously there's lens distortion, but then there's also every element inside of a lens changes the tone mapping of the lens.
Yep.
That's why we do all of our color charts and stuff like that. But mm-hmm. also the elements. Like right now, on this camera that I'm looking at you on, I have an old 58mm radiated Canon lens on a Sony body. Mm-hmm. And that glass is, you know, there's like, you know, whatever it is, 8 elements in there that have all been like, the lens has been dropped 3 or 4 times. And, yep. You know, they've all been bounced around. So that nothing is actually correct. And when you do that, like... for example, on season 1, we used a bunch of old Panavision lenses for the pilot on Foundation, and there was no way to replicate what they did. Mind you, Dina did a really good job of replicating that. But we also did, with our lens grids, we also did a bokeh board where we ran through the focus of all the lenses and showed. Like we had LEDs that showed where the anamorphosizer clipped the bokeh in the background, top and bottom, and you know we kind of built a gizmo for that, so that sure. when we did that in comp, they could find that correctly and actually match what was shot, which was Chris Keller and the guys did a great job at that. So, but it is it's a difficult thing to do, and it's hard. It's hard for people who haven't used a camera. It's hard for people that, you know, and I'm still finding that, or haven't been on set and seeing how the cameras work and what actually goes into filming something.
Sure.
You know, it's not just one guy running around with a camera. There's you know, 3 or 4 people involved.
Oh, shit. Yeah.
And just in the camera side of the shot, if there's a crane, there's three more people. If there's a remote head, there's another person, you know.
Yep.
And then there's a DIT, and you know, there's all of that stuff that goes into filming something. So it's we're starting to get really good at it. It's we're getting to the point where we can do anything, and the question's becoming, should we? A lot of the time. So that's kind of nice.
For sure. For sure. Yeah, for sure.
But
did my video? Okay, I don't know. Did my video disappear? Oh, yes.
Hold on.
I'll fix that in a second.
Bars, yeah.
I got bars. I'll fix that right away. Hold on a second.
All good.
Okay.
But you know Ian Spriggs, right?
Oh, yeah. I know him very well.
Yeah. 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 He's, him and I came up together a little bit at Mr. X.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. He had done, I think it was I can't remember what the advertisement magazine was, but he had done those covers. And we hired him, I think, for Three Musketeers or something. And the CG Soup on that had him modeling a knife. And I was like, no, we should probably have him on characters.
Uh-huh.
And then him and I became really good friends. And that's another thing that we like when, again, because I'm a little spastic when it comes to what I focus on.
Sure.
Him and I started to focus on anatomy, and you know that's where like we'd send each other. There was I can't remember what the gizmo was or the website was. It was like an old Flash game or something where you had to actually name parts of the body, and we would like send that to each other every morning. And yeah, that was always another thing too. How far. You had to become a pseudo expert in everything when it came to CG, and just kind of figure out as much as you could,
right?
About everything that you had to do to complete a shot,
right?
And that was But Ian, being the specialist he was, is now doing very well as the primo CG portrait guy. So
he is, and I think it's interesting that you just said that. I mean, because you know, like in the span of 5 minutes, you were talking about the intricacy of lenses, and then talking about anatomy, right? So those are two very different disciplines, and I think it's kind of enlightening to see that. Yeah.
Well, no, I mean it's, but that's, you know, over. I think I've been doing this now for 15 years, something like that, but. Over the span of that time, there's just so much stuff that I've had to focus on just to get the job done. That it's kind of you go from anatomy to shaders to lighting to cameras to even Python and VOPs and LOPs and SOPs and all that stuff in Houdini, and it breaks your brain a little bit.
Sure.
And now we've got to deal with Gaussian splatting and all that stuff on the horizon. So, it's becoming very, very, exciting again.
Do you find I found it ironic in some cases that the visual effects industry sometimes has a resistance to change, even though they are excited to change, but there's like, well, you know, we used to do it the old way, you know, whatever, you know. I remember for example, because Alex Alvarez was like, we're still going to do all characters with NURBS. I was like, really, Alex? You know, it was kind of, it's interesting, right?
I think that the resistance to change is twofold. Artists know what they know and don't necessarily want to change. Mm-hmm. And the other one is the, when a pipeline is built around the house of cards, or in some cases the Taj Mahal of cards that some places have built around the duct tape that's holding everything together,
sure,
to change something is starting from scratch, which is why smaller companies tend to be able to pivot to the new technologies faster, and you kind of get this leapfrog effect where a smaller company will do something better than a bigger company, or to figure out how to do it faster, just because they're able to maneuver outside of whatever they have built inside of their pipeline. So, a lot of companies, have their Skunk Works teams that go out ahead and try to figure this stuff out, which is great too. But it is important, I think, that everybody kind of pays attention, especially with all the neural net and machine learning and all of the craziness with that that's coming about now. So,
yeah, I'm curious about your thoughts on this, because obviously you've seen some of these changes, and there's a way, that for a long time, especially in those early 2000s, as we were talking about, where established pipelines were well established, right? And they were designated by tools, right? So it was like, everyone uses this specific tool for doing this specific task. And then the thing is that, the saying I always use, like when the only tool you know how to use a hammer, then everything looks like a nail, right? So, and so everything kind of looks the same because they're all tackled with the same tool. Mm-hmm. But what I think was interesting now is that it's not just the established, there's so many, like almost, there's probably like five since this morning tools of open source tools that have come out. They're like, oh, this could change everything, right? And it's just this constant open source ideas, this constant idea of people trying to catch up to some new ideas. And just in the realm of Gaussian splats, as you just mentioned, there's not one Gaussian, there's hundreds of Gaussian splat solutions out there. No one really knows which one's going to win, and no one seems to want to embrace one, because they know that whatever they embrace is going to be obsolete the next day. Like, how do we manage that sort of shift where it's turning so fast that it's hard to sort of change what we think?
Yeah, and I mean it's like the old VHS and beta, conundrum. Eventually, one will win out, or the PlayStation and Xbox thing.
Right.
I think eventually we'll either pick one, or companies will just segregate again and have different versions that work. You know, it's like Alembic and USD, right?
Mm-hmm.
Alembic was fairly, you know, it took a while, but everybody kind of caught on to that and started using it. USD has taken a lot longer and is now just kind of becoming a little more traditional, or not traditional, what's the word I'm looking for? A little more commonplace.
Standardized.
standardized, yeah. But it's taken a long time. Like it's been around.
Well, it needs to include so much, right?
Yeah.
And we definitely needed something beyond FBX and Alembic that needed a lot more.
Oh.
Yeah.
Yeah. But again, you know, with the Gaussian splat stuff, you look at what you're able to, if you're able to get a clean version of that. I was talking to Mark Atlant from Houdini about their, from Side Effects about mm-hmm. this. And, you know, the data footprint for that is so small.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you figure out a way to, you know, even if you're building a CG environment, you know, that's 3 billion polygons converted to a Gaussian splat, and then, you know, use that as your lighting file, or figure out a way to use that as your lighting file. That would change everything again, because you're now, you know, you're now able to push so much more data through the pipeline that much more quickly. And I think that's where, you know, to kind of be a little bit of a CG futurist about that, I think that's where this next step is going to take us, is, you know,
right.
doing that. That may actually become our new USD, or our new standards.
Yeah,
new standard for lighting pass through.
Yeah, I think you're right. Polygons might not be have much life left in some ways. But I was thinking about this maybe about 10 years ago, or maybe less than that. But with light fields, right? When everyone's talking about light fields, and I was like, okay, well, this is way too freaking heavy. But if we find some way of doing the definition of what a light field is in a much lighter process, then why would we need anything else, right?
Yeah. No, I know. I remember when, what was that giant camera?
Oh, Lytro.
Lytro. They had the aperture one. They're the one that you could change the focal length on.
Yep, that was the little butterstick one. Yeah.
Yeah. And then they built that giant cinema camera.
Huge.
And I remember...
Size
I remember
of a car.
Seeing it. I know it was like the computers in the 60s, and I was like, "This is great that you can do all this, but you know, can it move? Can you actually you know make a camera move with it? Well, will a cinematographer use this?
And, right?
I can't remember. I think did Google buy them or something?
Yes, they did. We Chaos was doing some work with them at some point a long time ago. But I mean, the fact is that light fields are fantastic, right? But there's enormous amount of redundant information that you get, because, you know, you've got, you know, 2,000 cameras that are 99% of what the other camera got. So it's a lot of redundancy. And so it was kind of interesting. All right, sorry, we don't need to geek out on that, but that's cool that you're thinking about these things a little bit. I do want to talk a little bit about going on set and that transition, of like how that sort of happened. Obviously, being a studio person and getting on set, and how that sort of happened, and then how did that lead to you being on Foundation?
I was at the studio. I started going on set when you started scanning actors.
As the asset guy.
As the asset guy, yeah. I spent some time there with a guy named Sean Mills. I think the first show I went on a set was Resident Evil. I think we were scanning with XYZ RGB out of Ottawa. I think they were from Ottawa.
Mm-hmm.
And just, you know, learning that process. And then when photogrammetry came along, it was like, oh, okay, well, we can, you know, we can probably build one of these systems ourselves. So being the dummy I did, I went home and tried to figure out how to build one of these systems. And we did. And we started using it. And, you know, it got pretty good. But then, you know, we got Mr. X got bought by Technicolor right around the time I built that system. Mm-hmm. So it kind of, it was there and we used it, but it never really developed much further than the 1.0 version of that. But we kept going on set. We kept using it. And then Crimson Peak was really the first show that I spent, you know, more than a week on set for. And that was kind of eye-opening. And that's when I started realizing that, you know, I was starting to make the connection between, you know, why things get done the way they do and why things aren't always perfect and why, you know, why don't they take the time to get this, you know,
because you have five minutes to make a decision,
five minutes to make a decision. And you know, it's, you know, $20,000 an hour, or $30,000 an hour to shoot. And, you know, it's, you know, you have to be as efficient as possible. So, that became very interesting. So we got into a bit of data wrangling and HDR, capture and things like that. Then it just became, Dennis Berardi, who ran Mr. X, for a long time. He's now got a new company called Herney Hill, Media, but he sent me out. I started doing, kind of shadowing him a little bit and working with him. And then, I think he thought he was sending me out to the wolves a little bit when he sent me to meet John Swallow. Cause you know, John Swallow was known as a bit of a no bullshit type of guy. Mm-hmm. Cause he ran Universal Visual Effects for 20 years. He was, you know, was a crazy, you know, crazy heavy hitter and, you know, was trying to make his comeback as a supervisor, after leaving that situation. And they needed me to go out as a representative for Mr. X on Godless. So I went out, I met John. John and I got along great. Cause neither one of us put up with much bullshit, which is great. And that's kind of why we got along, but, we spent the day on the train talking about photography, like, cause I'd already started getting into cameras and things like that. And, he basically said, great, Chris is great, whatever. And then, you know, I'm talking to Dennis at the end of the day, he's like, did he fire you? And I'm like, nope. And he's like, okay, well, you should be okay then. So, but that was the first show that I did with John Swallow, and really spent a lot of time on set there down in Santa Fe,
nice.
with Scott Frank and with John Swallow. And, you know, I actually spent a lot of time with Second Unit too, with a guy named Jeff Dashnaw, which is, you know, why I ended up getting into the DGA, and I'm actually doing Second Unit on Foundation now. So
nice.
But yeah, that was very eye opening. That was, being on Crimson Peak was one thing, but being on Godless with Scott and with that group of people, with Casey Silver and Mike Malone and those guys, it was a huge experience for me, and was like, okay, this is what I want to do.
Right,
and this is where I want to spend my time. So, and that's what ended up happening. And then I ended up doing American Gods and Highwaymen, and then now Foundation. So,
amazing.
But yeah, that's
amazing. So, let's talk a little bit about Foundation. Like, when you got into this project, what were some of the things? I mean, did you know much about the books or about any of that stuff before you got into it?
I knew about the books. I knew that we were starting. I hadn't read them. I'm not going to lie about that. So I read the book. I read the first book on my way to my interview at Skydance. and I was like, oh shit, we're going to make a show about white men talking in space with sideburns. Uh-huh. about nuclear fission and organic tobacco.
Right.
And in a phonetic Kentucky accent. And then, they sent me the first script and I was like, okay, no, that's not what we're doing. This is much more exciting than that. Right. It, you know, just with the space elevator and the tether fall and all of that. And then I basically went for the interview. It was right after the premiere of season 2 of American Gods in Hollywood. So I went in and, you know, I'd had some fun the night before, wasn't expecting anything. Got a call back from them, said, yeah, we'll hook you up with David Goyer. David and I had a Zoom. I was the third person David had talked to. The other two people, I won't name them, but said that the show was too crazy and could never get done. My whole deal was, we shoot as much, get as much in camera so we can spend the money on the big stuff. And we tried to do that as much as possible, and it worked to a certain extent. And that's kind of the mantra that we've carried forward, with all of this, into season three. But the rest is kind of history. We landed in, they hired me in March. We were in Iceland by, I think, late April, May. They had the original production designer, I think he went to go do Snake Eyes. I knew Rory Shane from American Gods was available, so his name got brought in the loop, and he got hired. So it was, him and I, and David Goyer and Michael Malone flying around Iceland looking for locations, and Malta and the Canary Islands and Ireland, and it just moved very quickly after that, and that's kind of how that all transpired.
I worked on Oblivion, and like those Iceland plates are like perfect for a lot of sci-fi material.
yeah except we scouted in June and went back to shoot in November.
Very dark.
Productions, it seems like they always scout in optimal weather and then they shoot at the worst time possible,
right?
It's just the nature of the beast. But we had sets blow off mountains. We had at one point, we actually had to leave Iceland, and we moved all of Terminus to the Canary Islands, because where we had set up and where we had wanted to shoot it, we had found unexploded ordnance from when the army was there during Desert Storm practicing. So there was a couple unexploded tank shells that we found in the field where we were shooting the vault. And
wow.
So that's there's video on somebody's phone of us exploding of the demolition people exploding that, but it was pretty wild. The Canaries was great. It's very, it was as volcanic as Iceland without the weather problems.
Right.
A lot more dusty, but we were able to kind of use that volcanic landscape in the same way. So it was really good. It was a serendipitous shift.
How have you noticed the change of the scope or the things that you've been doing over? This is your third season, right, on the show. So how have you seen the evolution of that scope as you've been moving along?
It's just getting the season one was a huge world building task. Mm-hmm. It was a feat of the imagination to come up with that world of Foundation, the Cleons and Trantor and Terminus and all of that. Season two went a little more wild. Season one, I kind of say, is like our, it's like our acid rocks phase. And then season two was our kind of punk rock phase. Everything got a lot faster. A lot more choppy, and we were kind of tripping over ourselves a little bit to get things done, but the stories turned out better. The character development was better. Mm-hmm. I can't say much about season three, season two, season two was definitely crazier. There was a lot more, we had, I keep telling everybody, we have every type of visual effect you can imagine on the show. So,
right.
It all becomes very integrated with what the directors want to do and how they want to shoot, and then reminding them of the rules that we've set up to make sure that we don't have to make up you know, holograms of convenience or all of these things that we do just to kind of make the plot along with the sci-fi MacGuffins. So we try to keep them away from using that stuff too much. And again, also just to kind of focus our efforts on the big sequences and the places where it actually pays off to spend the money and not have 500 wig fixes or set extensions on a set that, you know, when they're shooting off of it or things like that. So that's really the in terms of scope, we're definitely expanding it as every year or every season. Because of COVID, SAG strikes and WGA strikes, it seems like it takes like 2 years to do a season of Foundation.
Right.
We're hoping that there's no more things get tossed our way now. But
we definitely seem to be on the upswing now at this point in terms of where that's going, which is great. What are some of the big, besides those specific production challenges, what are some of the biggest challenges that you've thought in terms of the visual effects on these shows? I guess you can't talk about season three that much, but season two, for example.
Season two, it's because we're a location show and not a studio show. Mm-hmm. It's getting everybody to buy into the, lack of ability to put up blue screens and put up green screens. Everybody who, from directors to grips to cameramen, that's kind of been a crutch for them over the last, 20 some odd years. People don't really pull keys anymore. I know that everybody on social media, freaks out when they turn the screens gray or blue or whatever, blue screen gray or they look at what Paul Lambert's been doing on Dune with the sand screens and things like that. But, with the resolution we're getting out of the cameras, and the roto technology and what everybody's doing right now, it's actually less useful and actually more cumbersome for us to move as quickly as we need to put those screens up, unless there's a lot of visual noise behind what we're shooting and what we want to, key. We tend to only use them in those circumstances. And also, we also use a lot of atmosphere, which most people shy away from. But it actually, when you get that kind of, you almost get a natural depth cueing from that atmosphere that helps with the roto and helps with the separation. That's something that has been difficult, not difficult, but interesting to see people try to change their view on that a little bit. And also, depending on where you are, that stuff can be expensive, prohibitively expensive to put up.
Right.
It's not something that we necessarily use a lot of. And also, we have a lot of blue and green costumes, so.
For sure. Yeah. What are your thoughts on in-camera visual effects?
LED walls and
LED walls volume. or real-time compositing or any kind of real-time stuff.
It's virtual production on set. Definitely helps everybody understand what we're doing. I use some augmented reality to show directors where ships are, where the vault is, things like that, because, they often think that it's smaller than it is, or they don't frame it the right way or something like that. So the AR has definitely become very helpful. We do a lot of, not necessarily you know previs compositing or anything like that, but we do, you know, we do have a video switcher that we use for, you know, our composites when we're doing separate passes and things like that. And we did do some volume work on season one, a little bit on season two. It's a great tool for actors and for, capturing out of focus backgrounds. But, when you focus on them, unfortunately they moiré and the color shift and the,
right.
You know, the shift doesn't help us out that much. But there were a couple sequences. There's a sequence in season one, I think it was episode two, where Raish and Gale were sitting on a rock and we had shot a time lapse of Hecla that we brought back to the studio and put up an LED wall and shot it all against that. So that worked out really well. And it was good because they were actually in a simulator where they had to rewind the sunset so we could actually do that on camera and they could see it and they could react to it, which was great. But I think there's a, you know, as technology develops and as it gets easier, there's no reason not to use it as long as it's not cost prohibitive.
Right.
Because it does become, you know, you have to convince producers and convince everybody that, you know, there's a different pipeline you need to build for this. You have to, you know, you have to give us 6-8 months of lead time to be able to build
get our assets. Right. Yep.
You know, all of that sort of thing. And you know, for a producer, it's kind of scary sometimes if they haven't done it before. And, you know, there's not very many people who have done it before.
Mm-hmm.
So at this point, it's kind of a, with the LED screens anyways, in the volumes, it's a newish situation for anybody outside of commercials or Lucasfilm.
Right.
I forget the name of the, Netflix show that used it for the boat.
I can't remember. Yeah.
It's like $18.99 or something like that. Mm-hmm. But it's useful, but it can also be cumbersome in the wrong hands.
Yeah. I think it's fascinating that, you know, that there's been this process and this shift, and you might have noticed it over the years as well, that there's been this conversation about visual effects that sort of had this up and down period, right? I mean, where there's been people that, you know, I call it the pinnacle was the Life of Pi days, where people were really kind of coming down on visual effects and the technology were used. And now I think it's interesting as well that we're back to that point where people are pretending that there's no visual effects being used in films when it clearly is. And it seems to be a marketing decision for studios to say this was all done for real, right? And sort of diminishing all the work that we do in collaboration with the actual filmmakers in a lot of ways. So it's kind of, what do you think about that narrative that's been going on and how people are trying to correct it in the visual effects industry?
I think that we just have to keep fighting the good fight, and I'm a very loud character when it comes to, trumpeting our work and trumpeting our involvement in filmmaking. And, luckily David Goyer felt the same way on this show, which, you know, we were able to promote the visual effects. We were able to promote, you know, how well Rory and I work together, production design and visual effects coming together to make something look cool and make it look as real as possible and make everybody forget about the visual effects and just think, oh, this is just cool. And that is essentially our job, is for people not to go, oh, that's some CG bullshit.
Right.
They're just to go, oh, that's fucking cool. And then they carry on with the rest of the story.
Right.
And that's kind of where we need to continue to push that. Because, you know, the whole idea of, you know, not to throw stones, but I still think Top Gun Maverick would have made $1 billion whether or not they said the planes were real.
Right. Maybe, I'm not sure. I mean, a lot of people try to believe what Tom Cruise said, right? They want to believe that Tom Cruise was actually in an airplane or jumped off a cliff or whatever. That's his marketing, right?
Yeah, but he did fly in those planes, and they did shoot the planes, but they reskinned them with CG.
Right.
I mean, he did jump off a cliff and parachute. He did that like 8 times or whatever. Mm-hmm. But you know, they had to paint out the ramp and put a CG put a CG rock face in there and you know, do all of that. So it wasn't, you know, but that is where, you know, the magic of, and that's why, you know, kind of like what Chris Nolan does, is he doesn't really talk about it at all. Denis, you know, he just it's all part of filmmaking.
Sure.
And it's all part of the process. And we, you know, like now, you know, I'm second unit directing, you know, spending a lot of time in all these other departments with the physical production side of things. And, you know, they are just as important as the, you know, hundreds and thousands of artists after all the plates are shot and they have to do the work. But, you know, the animosity and the idea that that all of the artists sitting at desks grinding out the shots for everybody shouldn't get kudos. We definitely have to get over that,
right?
As an industry, you know, I think it's starting. Some of it starts with the unionization movement that we've been pushing. In Canada, the DGC has picked up the flag there. IATSE has as well. Some productions you can't work on now in Canada as a on-set supervisor or a data wrangler unless you're IATSE. So we are moving in the right direction in terms of getting that sort of recognition, but we're getting ourselves organized in that way. I don't think that's the recognition that we need, but you know, I don't think we should be scared to try to make our voices heard a little bit more when it comes to the production and how we interact with the physical side of production, because you know, it does help when we say, you know, give us our 30 seconds to get our HDR and our balls and charts. Otherwise, 6 months from now, you're going to be spending hundreds of thousands of dollars having us try to noodle this into place, or, you know, going to costumes and saying, "Hey, make sure that you take all the logos off your clothing so that we don't have to paint that stuff out," or you know, working with the hair and makeup people to make sure that everything works for 4K, and you know, we're not seeing you know, wig glue and things like that. And that's all just educating everybody. And you know, they're so, what I found is when you're willing to work with everybody and talk to them about all of these issues that cost money and take away from what actually ends up on screen, when it comes to the spectacle for, especially on Foundation, they're grateful and they love it and they want to be collaborative that way. And, you know, it's the same as like Rory with the sets. You know, if we can build it a foot taller and save, you know, $500,000 in set extensions or whatever it ends up being, it's like, let's build it, you know, let's make it taller. Let's use some real fake blood and not just expect it to be a visual effect all the time. And, you know, let's not be so scared to make decisions on set that we want all this wiggle room in post, and we want to make all these choices after the fact. It's like, no, just shoot it and, you know, have the cojones to get it in camera. And then we'll, you know, it will be better, and you will be more excited by the choice that you make half the time, more than half the time.
I think that's the thing I like most about in-camera visual effects, is that it is in-camera, right? So that the fact is that you are getting it and you are capturing it, and people are part of the process, right? And so filmmakers can see it and they are making the choices, right? They're not sitting there as like, well, I hope it looks better when I, in 6 months, you know, because I don't know what it looks like right now. So I think that's a nice thing.
No, it's, and that is why, you know, like we're a location show. We shoot a lot on location.
Yep.
So we, you know, yes, we're going to replace some of the backgrounds just because we have to, just to, you know, add whatever sci-fi, thing, characteristic we need to add to it. But being on location, being out in the elements, you know, being in, Fort Aventura for Terminus, with the wind and the sand and, you know, the dust and, you know, the heat and the cold, everybody reacts to that. You know, it's not, you don't have to, say, okay, now imagine you're doing this because this is happening. You know, they kind of get into it, and that's what's cool about it. And that is what's cool about virtual production as well. You know, it takes away the subjectivity that happens in post, where what if we make this 30% faster? What if we make this 30% slower? What if we animate this? I want this to go faster. You know, and that's usually the arguments I get into are you know, can we make the ships go faster? And I always say no, because it just makes them feel like toys.
Right. But, yep. It's amazing how people want to push the boundaries of physics. Right. Yeah.
But again, we can do anything, but should we?
Yeah, I did. I was, for my past lifetime, I did a whole lot of car commercials, and we had this incredible car simulator that was just the best thing and really, really imitating. But there was the amount of times that they wanted to sort of break the boundaries of what a car could actually do. It was like, if you actually made that turn physically, you would pass out. You know, it's like, it doesn't make any sense. But I want to get into real briefly about, you know, obviously there's been a lot of talk in the visual effects industry, and I'm trying to get everyone's sort of view on this in terms of how AI tools are getting a lot of backlash now. You know, you see someone using a marketing tool that suddenly is like, oh no, they used some AI something for a poster, and now everyone wants to cancel that show, right? Like, what are your thoughts about that process and how people are reacting to this and in general with how tools are being used?
I mean, you know, I think we have to be careful how we use them and what we use them for. I think there's exploitation to a certain degree based on the fact that they are data mining tools, a lot of them, that are just combing the internet looking. That's how the internet is the best data set for training these neural nets and training these algorithms. And unfortunately, there's a lot of copyrighted material on the internet, and the way that they're coming up with these images is by learning, looking at those images. Now,
if you look at an image and say, I want it to look like that.
Yeah. And we still do.
Right.
At a certain point, it used to be human input. So right. we would take that image and then we would interpret it in our own way.
Sure.
And now we've got, like a Midjourney or something that can manifest some version of what we think it should be very quickly without any brush strokes, any vertices pulled, you know, that sort of stuff. It's a bit daunting to think about, you know, who, like, aside from the legalities of what it is, once we sort out the copyright issues and everything else, I think to some extent we're all going to have to embrace some form of using AI. And now, you know, things like facial simulation and facial rigging, you know, Thanos, they used a lot of that for that. Ziva before they kind of got in with Unity, and they're now, I think they're now exclusive to DNEG. Mm-hmm. They were using some neural nets to train their facial muscle simulation. And, you know, that I don't think that's a bad thing, because I remember how many iterations it would take.
Tell me about it.
You know, to get it, because it's such a subjective thing. But if you take out like you know, Thanos was pretty good.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah, absolutely.
Like, if you look at Thanos versus now Thanos is a purple, character that isn't he's human like he's not actually human, but you know, it's, if you look at that versus you know, Peter Sellers from Rogue One. Mm-hmm. Is it Peter Sellers?
No,
Grand Moff Tarkin.
Or even like, you know, having worked at DD and like, you know, saw, you know, the devolution from Clue to Thanos, right? So like, if you look at Clue, right? And Clue, there was so many subjective decisions of like, I don't know, just shift it light, shift it left, maybe the eye, I don't know, something this, you know, and you're trying to figure it out. And it's so hard to do emotionally. I mean, that was the whole thing of when the Uncanny Valley. There is, I think you're right. AI tools really, really help tamper that Uncanny Valley problem in a really interesting way. Just because of the nature of the fact that they can solve it more objectively as opposed to subjectively, right?
Yeah, and I mean, like I remember Ed Taylor telling me all about that. You know, that the inside scoop on Clue's head and how long that took versus, you know, how long it took to do Tron's head.
Yeah.
You know, and how much time was spent there. And it's just, it's crazy. It's like, and you know, and then you go back a little bit further from you know, like, yes, supposed to be a perfect replica of Jeff Bridges. Mm-hmm. But then you go back further and you go to like the heyday of ILM and look at something like Pirates of the Caribbean, and how well that was executed. You know, that was really like when you're talking about the heyday of like Life of Pi,
Pirates of the Caribbean,
Benjamin Buttons, even Transformers, you know, those were insanely well done. And that was, I think that was the peak of kind of the artistry of what we were doing, and, you know, and I was watching it happen, because I was not at that level yet.
Right.
But I was watching everybody else work on these crazy characters, and, you know, trying to, and the photorealism and you know, just the artistry that went into making some of those shots it's just mind-boggling. And then you get to, you know, things like Fast and the Furious, or even some of the newer Marvel shows, and you just you wonder, you know, if we're just trying to do too much sometimes.
Well, my theory is, like, back in those days, like, it turns out the secret sauce is just hiring really good artists, and if you hire really good artists, you probably are going to be okay.
Yeah. And that's part of the problem too, is oversaturation and the needs. You know, some of the companies have gotten so big that you know, not everybody's going to be, you know, a Benjamin Button tier artist,
right?
And it's going to take, and they may eventually be someday, but you're never going to be able to staff every show with that caliber of artists. So. And that's you know, and part of what we do on Foundation is I, you know, like, we go in and we hire the people, we don't hire the companies, you know. So I talk to the supervisors, I talk to, you know, we have very good rapport with the artists, and, you know, we just try to make that work as opposed to, you know, the punch clock grind version of what we do, because, you know, this is supposed to be fun.
Sure. Yeah, I, if you're not having fun, then it's not worth it to me, honestly.
No. And if you're not learning and it's not fun, and, you know, it can be frustrating at times, but if you're, you know, at the end of the day, you're like, I don't want to go to work, then, you know, there's plenty of other things to do. But
awesome. Well, before we go, I'd like to, like, I know you said you can't say much on season 2, but is there something you can say, something you can look forward to, something to anticipate? When would we be able to see something?
I really can't say anything. Okay. I mean, other than the fact that, you know, we're in Prague in Poland right now shooting season 3, and
nice,
you know, we're gonna get it done soon. So
when is season 3 expected to come out?
I don't know yet.
Okay.
we're still.
Oh, with
all
the jumble and the strikes and everything, it's hard to sort of nail that down at this point, I'm sure.
Yeah. No. I honestly, this is like, you know, just because of the weird way that the Emmys are landing and all of the everything's coming out this year in terms of the timing shift. Just reminding everybody that season two is still out there and you can watch it, and season one.
Yeah.
but season two is out there, and it's you know, a lot of, like, you know, Mike Enriquez and myself, and, you know, all of the teams at you know, Rodeo, like Arno and Loreline at Framestore, and everybody that, you know, Outpost and Macavision or Accenture Song now. Mm-hmm. They all just nailed it. And you know, I hope they had as much fun on the show as I did.
Awesome.
You know, working with those folks and just getting everything to a level that David Goyer was happy with. So, that's really the gist of it. Is just trying to make this, you know, make visual effects fun again.
That's awesome. Because.
Yeah, I mean, we spend so much time talking about the politics and of it all, and, you know, making sure we get our comeuppance and everybody gets jaded and cynical, and that's something we don't talk a lot about. But it's you know, just trying to get everybody excited about what we're doing, and you know, everybody's worried about filmmaking going away. I don't think that's going to happen anytime soon.
So. I think we're too excited about storytelling, and there's too many tools out there to tell stories, and there's so much stuff that's been happening. So it's very, very exciting. I mean, honestly, secretly, I've been waiting for a Foundation series for a long time. I've been reading those books since I was a little kid. I just didn't know how they're going to pull off 1,000 years of history in one season.
The way that I explain it whenever anyone asks me is you know, the what Asimov wrote was an encyclopedic version of the story of Foundation.
Right.
And what we're doing is we're looking at that encyclopedia and we're going, okay, well, let's tell we're doing a character driven version of that.
Right.
So, and instead of the overarching view that Asimov took in the first book and,
right.
You know,
all right.
I will say that it's going to get pretty exciting.
Awesome.
You know.
Very exciting.
Yeah.
Well, cool, Chris. Thank you so much for doing this. I'm excited to you know, let people know about Foundation Season 3. Obviously, we'll be waiting a bated breath for that one to come out. So congratulations on that, and hopefully we'll be able to see it soon.
Well, thanks for inviting me on, and I had a great time. Thank you.